And it's really highlighted some of the sort of the continuing issues and problems I think we have in our healthcare system overall. So what I want to do today is talk a little bit more specifically about parity. And Andrew and Lori and others have already provided a fair amount of information on the parity law, and I think many of you, hopefully many of you, are knowledgeable about the law. So I'm going to go over that pretty quickly. And what I'm going to try to focus on are the degrees to which the difficulties we're having in implementing the parity law really are kind of a lens with regard to the overall problems we have in our healthcare system generally. As we talk about consumer awareness of the law, as we talk about the definition of medical necessity, as we talk about issues around the integration of care, it really highlights, I think, a lot of the challenges that we have in terms of our healthcare system generally. Mental Health America and I receive support from the pharmaceutical industry, from the health insurance industry, and from the federal government. And obviously, issues in healthcare reform and parity have implications for all three of those sectors. So I'm disclosing that we do have financial relationships with them. And I additionally do private consultation with all three of those entities as well. Andrew talked and Lori talked about the fact that in 2008, after many, many years of work, we passed the Mental Health Addictions and the Mental Health Equity and Parity. I can't get it. Yeah, the Mental Health and Addictions Equity Act, which was not named by a focus group. And here we have President Bush in actually a FAW signing of the bill. The bill actually passed and was used as a vehicle for implementing the Emergency Stabilization Act, and that's the way it got out of the House of Representatives. Another very interesting story. But here you can see Senator Kennedy and Domenici, Patrick Kennedy, Congressman Kennedy, and Congressman Ramstad. And unfortunately, all four of those individuals are no longer serving in the Congress, which makes our job harder, not having advocates of their weight and significance. As everybody said, the parity law basically says that plans cannot impose financial and treatment limits on mental health and substance use disorder benefits that are not imposed on medical benefits. And Andrew talked about copays and visit limits, which are, in many ways, the easy part of the bill. Andrew also talked about the fact that in order to get the bill passed, these services could not be mandated. So it's only if the insurance company chooses to offer a mental health and substance use benefit, it has to be offered at parity. It's getting to be more and more of a no-brainer that you can't have a competent insurance policy if it doesn't have a mental health and substance use benefit. But that was largely fixed by the Affordable Care Act, ACA, which does mandate the inclusion of mental health and substance use benefits for the exchanges and Medicaid expansion program, and they have to be offered at parity. And remember that Andrew talked about the fact that the small group market was specifically excluded from the Parity Act in order to accommodate the needs of the small business lobby. And by including it in the exchanges, it essentially addresses that huge component of the population that was not covered in the parity law. So one of the themes I think you should be taking from these presentations overall is we've really made some very important progress over the last several years in addressing some critical core components of our healthcare system. Lori talked a lot about the importance of early identification and screening, and Catherine talked about the implementation challenges of trying to get, once we have the law in place, it's actually making the law work. But we've got some infrastructure now that we've not had before, and as a public health body, it's our responsibility to really make sure that we drive these things home and get the implementation done correctly. Rosalynn Carter, who's featured here with Dave Wellstone, Senator Wellstone's son, who were great champions of this, provided testimony about many of the problems that presented barriers to care. And these are well understood, I think, by everyone here. And what I want to do is talk about the major challenges in implementing the law. So in some sense, this is really kind of a nice follow-along to Catherine's presentation about EPSDT, what's in the statute, and then what actually happens on the ground. And I've identified several areas where there are challenges, public education, the compliance of insurance companies. As Andrew said, some of the stuff that's going on in the insurance industry is actually shocking to me, and I think it is so incredibly poorly informed in terms of the insurance company's own self-interest, but we'll talk a little bit about that. this notion of the definition of equity and benefits turns out to actually be trickier than you would think. And again, as we think about this through the lens of our health insurance system generally, and some of the enigmas that present themselves as we try to understand, well, what's equitable treatment? How do you understand whether or not, in fact, it's equitable? There are issues with enforcement, and as I said earlier, I think all of these clearly reflect the problems in terms of our overall health insurance system in this country. Knowing that the APHA has for many, many years favored a single-payer system, I think that this would probably be a sympathetic audience for many of these concerns. In 2010, the American Psychological Association did a survey that indicated that almost 90% of the public were not aware that there was a Mental Health Parity and Addictions Equity Act. And so clearly job one is just to make sure that people realize that those benefits have to be provided to them equitably, and that they demand from their providers and their insurance companies that they be delivered. And NAMI and MHA, and we actually have a large parity coalition involving both the mental health and the substance use communities, are trying to do all we can to educate the public. Part of the problem is that the law is complex. Connie Francis, who the older people in the room will remember, and the younger people have no idea who she is a person who has had significant mental health problems in her life. She tried to do some, she has done some public service announcements for us. And after she agreed to do them, she actually reached out to us. She called up and she said, "What?" She said, "You know, I was talking to someone about Medicare, and they said that, you know, there's not parity in Medicare for mental health benefits." And I said, "Yeah, Connie, that's right, unfortunately. You know, we have such a fragmented, difficult health care system that the parity law doesn't apply to the Medicare system. There's another set of laws that we've been working on, which in 2014 should mature in Medicare, but it's a very complex system. And if you're not into like Rube Goldberg thinking, it's very difficult to understand how the American healthcare system works. Issues of compliance are dense. We'll talk about those in a bit in terms of what Andrew highlighted as these non-quantitative treatment limitations. And we have an important role, all of us do, but government and advocacy particularly have an important role in terms of educating people about the benefit. Insurer compliance is another complex set of issues, and this highlights just a few of the issues that have been have emerged with regard to compliance. Immediately after the law was passed, you know, part of the way we have our health insurance organized with regard to behavioral health is the use of behavioral health carve-outs, which in some sense reflects this sort of traditional division between the behavioral health system, which at one time was characterized by state-run large institutions, pretty much essentially, and general health conditions. We've had these sort of separate and unequal development, and in some sense one could argue that the behavioral health carve-outs continue to reflect that, with specialty organizations organizing and delivering behavioral health services, and that benefit being carved out of the general health benefit. Right after the law was passed, several of the behavioral health carve-out organizations, who were our strong allies when we were passing the parity law, tried to enjoin its implementation because the regulations indicated that you couldn't have separate deductibles, right? You couldn't have a mental health deductible and a general health deductible. You needed one deductible. Having separate deductibles would have been inequitable. The carve-out industry sought to enjoin the law because they said, "Hey, we don't know what people are getting in terms of their general health care. How can we be held to an equity standard when we don't know what the health services are that a person or what their copayments have been?" I don't think I need to say any more. Fortunately, the injunction was not successful and the law went forward. And part of what we're trying to do now is to integrate. Andrew talked about HIT in general, we're trying to get an integrated health record. It just makes sense that you should know everything that's happening with regard to a person's health, and these separate and unequal systems are not appropriate. This pre-authorization criteria, the Blue Cross and Blue Shield plans in Florida, Illinois, and perhaps one other state have implemented in response to the parity law. Pre-authorization requirements for all outpatient, have tried to implement pre-authorization requirements for all outpatient mental health services. I mean, to our mind, that on the face of it, it contradicts both the law spirit and the letter. They argue, however, that's a medical necessity determination based upon these non-quantitative treatment limitations. Illinois, I think, Andrew, has reversed themselves on this. I'm not sure. Florida, where I still vote and formally, legally live, is continues to be an ongoing embarrassment to me in terms of the various shenanigans that go on in that peninsula of the country. And enforcement is decentralized and problematic. So we have a very decentralized healthcare system. There are hundreds and hundreds of plans and thousands of administrators. So this makes our job much more difficult. How do you determine equity in terms of benefits? You know, we always, the parity law always anticipated that benefits would be managed. There was no sense that this would be sort of an open-ended entitlement to whatever people wanted. And in fact, you know, that moving from the RAND health insurance experiments that showed this tremendous demand elasticity based upon price, which the Blues and others have used for years to say this was an unaffordable benefit, to where we are now, requires an intelligent management of the benefit. So the quantitative aspects of that are relatively easy, and Andrew talked about that. It's these non-quantitative, these medical necessity criteria and scope of services that become trickier in terms of determining equity. Interestingly, in order to determine what's equitable between general health services and mental health substance use services, requires that we have access to the medical necessity criteria that are used to determine what's medically necessary on the general health side, and the law that requires that there be transparency in terms of this decision process. What we learned as we went about trying to implement this is that many insurance companies hold their medical necessity and medical management practices as proprietary. So there are things that are secrets. We can't learn about those because those are the magic that we use to make our healthcare system work so spectacularly. And it becomes very difficult to compare equivalents when you can't get access to those medical necessity criteria. So we're working with the Department of Labor, HHS, and Treasury to try to get the insurance companies to conform with the law, because without that, it's nearly impossible to determine whether or not people are getting equitable treatment. Evidence based for medical necessity decisions that is very uneven. If you look at the technology assessment that's used in cardiac treatment or other areas, there are many, many, many procedures on which there is no randomized clinical trial data that they are effective, but they're judged medically necessary because of the preponderance of clinical judgment. If you try to use the and so, therefore, it's inequitable to apply a medical necessity criteria on the behavioral health side that requires numerous randomized clinical trials for every one of these decisions. We have had, I've now worked in this field, I was reminded this weekend, like over 30 years, which is pretty incredible in and of itself. We have kind of self-esteem problems in mental health. I think we've often thought of our services as less effective, less worthy, less desirable, and this is a chance for us to get past that. You know, the scientific basis for our work is as strong as any other area of medicine, and this is a chance for us to get that through. I don't have time to go into this, but you can imagine trying to establish equivalence of conditions, right? So if you think about, well, what kind of rehabilitative services should be medically necessary for persons who have severe disabling mental illnesses, as both Laurie and Catherine said, you know, because of the fact that we under-recognize and under-treat, many people become disabled, and then Andrew talked about the fact that we have this perverse incentive that the only way you can get health insurance is you have to be completely disabled in our country. You have that. What's equivalent of that? What should we use to say, I mean, is it a young person who has a stroke, for example, or a young person who has a spinal cord injury? What's the criteria that's used for what's appropriate medically necessary rehabilitative services? These are actually very complicated questions, but I think that they beg really important issues about what's sort of the role and function of our healthcare system. Equivalence of medical management practices is very difficult then until we can start to understand those. But I think there's some very helpful discussions that we can have. Provider networks are important. Again, the great state of Florida, the Blues down there, as I understand it, completely fleshed out their behavioral health and reinstituted it at a much lower reimbursement rate, basically causing tremendous disruption in that system. And when you think about equivalence of benefit, the networks have to be equivalent. The degree to which and the ways in which services are reimbursed have to be roughly equivalent. So there are lots of complicated issues that need to be addressed. These are not trivial issues. You know, we did a study in 2009 where we looked at access to care and its relationship to the parity law, and we found that states that had better parity laws, you know, Andrew said that 43 states had passed parity laws, actually had much better access to care and significantly lower suicide rates. So these are very serious. Matters, and that was with an N of 51. We found that effect. So it's a pretty robust effect if you can find it when you only have 51 observations, and those are the 51 states. So there are lots of issues for researchers in terms of trying to understand equivalence of benefit and how we can go about sort of doing some of these comparisons, which I think are an important part of the strategy that we need to implement in order to really fully start to integrate our healthcare system. Unfortunately, I am getting the hook from my friend and long-term colleague, Lori Flynn, and so I'm not going to be able to talk in any great depth or extensively about those issues. But let me just conclude by saying that the difficulties in implementing this law, and it's critical that passing the law is always step one. It's really critical that we get this thing implemented. Really, I think, represent very clearly the structural and functional problems with the insurance system in this country, our historical discrimination against behavioral health benefits, and suggest many important research and methodology questions around these issues of determining equivalence, how to motivate individuals to demand care that is legally due to them, et cetera, et cetera.